and welcome to the very first episode of the Breakfast All Day podcast. We are now Breakfast All Day.
We are. Yes. What the Flick is no more. And, of course, What the Flick did involve a crew of talented cameramen, lighting directors, yes, editors. We don't have that anymore.
We have Nick Lemire, who took time out from playing Lego Marvel Super Heroes 2 to press the button on Alonzo's phone.
And we are grateful.
Thank you, Nick. I'm Christy.
I'm Alonzo.
I'm Matt.
We exist. We exist in the world. Happy New Year to all of you. Happy New Year to you guys.
Yes, happy 2019.
I will say that we've dropped the ball a little bit. Our first Breakfast All Day show, where is the breakfast?
I didn't want to, you know, overplay that hand.
I'm having tea.
I mean, I guess we have the rest of the day to still have
breakfast. People really hate it when you eat in the microphone. That's been my experience. Unless you're really into ASMR, you do not want to hear that.
What's ASMR?
It's that thing where people whisper and they say words like crack-a-tack-a-tack, and it like helps you fall asleep. It makes tingles in your scalp. Do you know about this?
No.
Oh, you have a whole
that
new avenue of YouTube.
That's where the crackers come from.
That's where Borat is from.
No. Kazakhstan.
Okay, so it's the beginning of the year. It's January, which is notoriously a terrible, terrible time for films. So we are going to, for the most part, blow off whatever is new this week.
Yes. Right. And we're going to kick things off. We're moving forward with a new venture. And yes, Ben will be joining us when Ben can join us. But in the meantime, you know, welcome. We'll be looking back at 2018 and talking about our best and worst films of the year.
Right. And we have a little bit of movie news for you as well. And we have a couple movies we're going to review. But let's start out with our best of, right? There were some really great movies last year to the extent, and I know I say this every year, but to the extent that, like, I had a really hard time. Alonzo couldn't even narrow his down to 10.
I know. I kind of cheated. I did a top 25. And that's the thing. Like, whenever people complain about, oh, the movies are so terrible, it's like, maybe the movies that made the most money or the movies that played in the most theaters were not the greatest all the time, which is just kind of always the case. But I think if you're paying attention, and even now with Netflix and Hulu having so much great stuff going on, I mean, like, you know, even if you live in the middle of nowhere with no art house theater, you know, you could watch Roma on Netflix. You could watch Happy as Lazaro on Netflix, you know, not to mention stuff, you know, that wound up there later. My gauge is always, I could always recommend something to somebody at any time of year.
Yes. You want to start then, since you are recommending things? What's your number one movie of the year?
My number one movie of the year is, I'm kind of torn, actually, because I did a narrative film and a doc film list. And my number one's on both of them.
It was hard to pick.
It's weird. I feel weird putting those two against each other. I think they're very different. You know, but anyway.
Wait, you mean some movies aren't true?
My number one narrative was Paddington 2, because it is.
Did go for that. You stuck with that all year long,
I gotta
say. Oh,
yeah, I saw
that movie
in January of last year, and I wrote it all year, because it is a gorgeous movie. It is a sweet movie. It's a movie about Brexit. You know, it's a movie about the world that we live in right now, and it's an antidote against the world.
I will also point out, this was the movie that I was shocked to find out that you had left before the credits sequence.
I know. Well, I had to.
I did too.
I had to go podcast somewhere, and so on your advice, I saw it a second time and stayed, and I'm so glad I did.
Yeah, I missed it
a few more times since then.
Have you seen it since?
No, I've not, because I brought Nick with me, and he had to go to the bathroom.
It's on HBO.
You guys are killing me.
Right. We also realized he just rewatched Black Panther yesterday, and we realized that we also got up before the last credit scene there because he had to go to the bathroom, because it's like 2.5 hours long.
Yeah,
right?
But a Marvel movie, they've trained us now that we cannot budge until that final.
Anyway, I do know better.
So that was my number one narrative film. My number one documentary film was Minding the Gap, which is screening on Hulu right now. Have y'all seen this film?
Yeah, it's our LA Film Critics Awards are next weekend, and Minding the Gap won our best editing award.
And it was runner up for Doc.
It's excellent. It's really good.
Yeah, it's a beautiful film, and the way it had been pitched at me, it premiered at Sundance last year, and I think it started airing on Hulu like in August, and I didn't get around to it because I kept hearing, oh, it's about these skateboarders. I was like, well, that's nice, but like that kind of undersells the film. I mean, yes, they are skateboarders. They grew up together skateboarding. You see all this footage of them, you know, throughout their lives skateboarding. But it's really a story about three guys with kind of damaged childhoods reaching adulthood and all sort of making the decision of not perpetuating the kind of family life they grew up in as they become adults and start, you know, making their own decisions and living on their own. It's a moving film. It's powerful. It was one of the last films that I saw before doing my top 10 list. And I remember I was sitting on my sofa in my bathrobe sobbing.
Oh, wow.
It was, I found it just devastating emotionally. It's a beautiful film. Really, check it out. It's on Hulu, Minding the Gap.
Yeah, as it goes along, it is not so much about skateboarding. It's about, like, the bittersweet growing up process and how it tears them apart. And they struggle to regain the thing that bound them, which was the skateboarding.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's very intimate. And yet there's a universality to that element of it, where you grow up and you don't have as much in common anymore with the people that you thought were formative to you.
And you have to figure out what your own adulthood is going to be like, and if it's going to be like what you were raised in, or if you're going to sort of figure out a new path.
Right. You know? Do we all become our parents?
Yeah.
Or not? Right. So what is your number one then?
You know, it's a tough one. I didn't put my list together until I got here.
It's okay. But did you not know at the end of last year what your number one was?
No, because I don't tend to think that way. I think part of it is having spent so much time at Rotten Tomatoes, like looking at the list and everything. The things that really work for me are, because it's ironic because like we did all these lists and stuff. Like I don't necessarily rank movies. It's like, what are the ones that move me and what are the ones that I would see again?
Sure.
And what are the ones that make me realize this is why I do what I do, mm-hmm. right? And so a lot of times it's that sense of discovery. It's that sense of surprise and coming out of a movie and just being completely caught off guard. That being said, I loved Black Panther. Like I went into Black Panther thinking Black Panther was going to be great, hoping it was going to be great, and it absolutely delivered. And there's a few movies like that. Paddington 2 managed to be possibly even more moving than the first one.
Mm-hmm.
That one, that's a rare, you know, big major movie that still manages to surprise. I loved Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
Totally.
Like that was, you know, expectations were high. That one was terrific. I loved Wreck-It Ralph. You know, a couple of horror movies that I loved, like A Quiet Place.
Mm-hmm.
Was amazing. Hereditary.
Loved Hereditary.
Was so good.
Now, A Quiet Place, I find, I loved it while I was watching it and immediately afterwards, but the further away from it I get, the more I find myself sort of picking holes in the whole thing.
There are so many questions.
Does it still hold up for you even after all this time?
It does. I mean, look, there's a lot of movies that still have holes for me, but that one I really liked. I think it holds up relatively well. But the ones that really were surprising, I'd say probably, you know, if I'm going to take a page out of Alonzo's book and do best doc and best narrative, I would say my favorite narrative, although I loved Eighth Grade, I would say The Writer. The Writer was the one that just completely caught me off guard. And it's just such a beautiful film. And it's one of those things like drop everything and see it. It's just an amazing movie. And then the other one that the doc that, and we raved about this a few weeks ago, you know, my favorite docs are the ones that tell you a story that you never really, like, give you information that you didn't know existed and still make you feel something, and that's Bathtubs Over Broadway.
Wow. Okay.
I was just talking about that with people over New Year's Day. A guy, a friend of ours who is a Broadway producer, and he loved it. And he's like, I just discovered this, and it's so strange, and I loved it. So, yeah.
I got the book for Christmas.
Ooh, nice. Yeah, so I would say those. You know, Writer was probably my favorite narrative, and Bathtubs Over Broadway is probably my favorite doc.
Okay.
By the way, my close second doc, which also LA Film Critics honored as the doc this year, is Shirkers, and it's on Netflix. Please go watch it.
It is, and if I may tout our LA Film Critics Awards again, I get to give Sandy Tan the Best Documentary Award on that Saturday night, so I'm excited to see her. Yeah, so my favorite movie of the year is The Favorite, with Without a You. The Favorite. I was blown away by it. I'm inclined to like Yorgos Lanthimos anyway.
Sure.
And loved Dogtooth and The Lobster. I really liked Killing of a Sacred Deer. But this I loved because it's like it marries so much that shouldn't work, right? It looks like this very beautiful and rich and safe and staid kind of royal period piece.
Costume drama.
Yeah. And it's not. It's like it's anachronistic in the most fun, daring ways. And it's gorgeous, but there's something a little messy about all of it, whether like maybe a dress is a little bit off or the makeup's a little bit smeared. All three of those actresses are just tremendous. Mm. And the more you watch it or upon repeated viewings, perhaps, you're sympathy shifts with all of them, because perhaps at first you really feel for Emma Stone because she's new here and she's abused and she's lost everything and she's clawing her way back. You might feel more for Rachel Weisz because she's true and she's loyal. She's mean, but she runs shit. You know, she's in charge, and that gets taken away from her. Or do you feel for Olivia Colman in the center, who is so needy and so misunderstood and seemingly so damaged and unlikable, but the more you watch her, the more you really feel for her because she's being manipulated and she constantly questions who she can trust.
Right.
So I just love the mix, the way it's shot, like these thrilling tracking shots down these hallways. I love the big dance scene.
The fisheye lens where
a lot of fisheye. Yeah.
You have like the space.
Yeah. Yeah. So I dug the favorite. That's my absolute favorite. But you know, we all have others on our top 10 list. So I'll just list out a few others I had on my list. I think you and I have some overlap in ours. I have Roma is my number two.
Mine
Burning.
Too. That was in my top 25. Yeah.
Burning is amazing. Go see Burning. Don't let anyone tell you about Burning except go see Burning.
Leave No Trace.
That's a really good one. First Reformed I have on my list.
Yes, top 25 for me.
So Suspiria is on my top 10 list. Suspiria is on Alonzo's worst list. This is like my favorite conversation to have with you ever because you're so flabbergasted by the fact that I evolved on this. Like we talked about it the first time and I'm like, I don't get it. I don't love Suspiria. And then I saw it again and I'm like, I get it. I totally get it now.
You know what? This is like, it's like hearing people talk about Est, you know, it's that thing of like, you know, with EST back in the 70s where, you know, there's some by
there
some magical,
a movie, right? Personal Est.
By some magical process, like they've reached this level of understanding, and sadly I have not. Well, maybe that's the case, but I thought the movie was horseshit, and it was a great disappointment for me from a director that I love. And you know, I liked Mother, and I understood the people who hated Mother, and I hate Suspiria, and I don't understand the people who like it. But whatever, if it works for you, I'm happy.
It does, and I went as Dakota Johnson for Halloween this past year in the gray sweatpants, not in the like red ropey bikini situation.
Oh,
no one needs to see that
in the granny panties.
Yeah.
No, not barf you. I meant that.
No,
the costume's ridiculous.
Not
all around.
Not tied up like in 50 Shades Free.
No. No one needs to see that either. That's for the privacy of my own home, man.
There you go.
Sorry to Bother You is on my list. Eighth Grade, I know Alonzo and I both have. Hereditary, I have with you.
We should mention Other Side of the Wind, Orson Welles' final film, which was reconstructed again by Netflix. That was on my top 10. And then the documentary about the making of that film, They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, was on my top 10 docs. So those are both available on Netflix, along with a third documentary hidden in the Trailers and More section of Other Side of the Wind called A Final Cut for Orson, that's about the reconstruction of the movie, that's also fascinating.
I'm glad you brought up the favorite, because there's a couple things I was thinking about when you were talking about it. On the way Olivia Colman's character is treated, the Queen. It's an interesting companion. Like, you could do an interesting double feature with that and Mary, Queen of Scots, about women in power not knowing who they can trust. And one of them is the satire, and then one of them is the Yorgos Lanthimos. No. And then the other one is Rachel Weisz had a hell of a year between that and Disobedience.
I love Disobedience.
Right. So you could have your Rachel Weisz lesbian film festival.
That is true.
Right?
Always available to you. Yes.
Also having a good year was John C. McGinley. Great. In The Sisters Brothers, which is on my top
John C. Riley.
Somebody else.
You're thinking of the guy on Love Boat.
And Scrubs. No.
Guy
on Scrubs. That's Ted McGinley.
Ted McGinley.
This is going to get, we're spiraling out of control. John C. Reilly had a great year this year with
Ted the Teddy Bear.
The Sisters Brothers and
Stan and Ollie
and Ralph Breaks the Internet, which you like more than I did. And, Holmes and Watson, but that movie's not good for anybody.
Yes. Alonzo and I both have Support the Girls on our list.
That was a great movie.
Yeah. And then my number 10, just because it's like the most entertaining kind of blockbuster to me of the year, was A Star Is Born. I dug it. I still have The Shallow stuck in my head. I can't get it out.
I had a sad boy and his horse movie, but it was not The Rider. It was Lean on Pete.
Mm.
It's a motif. Do you have any worsts that you want to share, Matt? What are the worst movies of the year?
You know, this was an interesting year because I spent a lot of time, you know, having with the previous job. I saw a lot less movies than I would typically get a chance to. So that gave me the ability to skip a bunch of terrible movies. Mm. That being said, Nutcracker was terrible.
Yep, that's on my list, too. That's on Alonzo's list, too.
What is going on here?
That's on Nick's list, too. I made him go see it.
I was two directors and...
I was shocked at how terrible Peppermint was.
Mm. That's on your list, Alonzo.
Peppermint was terrible.
I had a three-way tie of Peppermint, Proud Mary, and Red Sparrow, which is like strong female protagonists with weak-ass screenplays.
Yeah, Proud Mary was bad. Red Sparrow was really bad. Mm. Like, Red Sparrow...
Just sent me to horror school.
Well, right. Like, the misogyny of that movie is shocking. And that was terrible. Happy Time Murders was a lot funnier when it was called Avenue Q.
Yep. Or Team America World Police.
No, or the granddaddy of them all, Meet the Feebles. Yeah. That's a much better version of this. This one is like, okay, I mean, Happy Time Murders was very much like, you know, okay, Henson, we get that you guys like to screw around with when you guys are doing the puppets, like... We don't need to see that.
That doesn't. It's we need to see it in an actual
in a clever way.
Sure,
it's just an idea. This is a one joke movie,
but it's all been done, right?
And
it's been done.
That can't be your only go-to.
Right. So if you're going to go to that, you got to bring something new to the table and actually be more than just shocking.
Life itself.
Oh yes,
I didn't see that one. 50 Shades Freed. We're all freed from that finally.
Did have one of the biggest laughs of the year, but it was purely unintentional.
And as much as I kind of like the book, the big budget movie, I just hated was Ready Player One.
Yep.
Like, Ready Player One is so...
Like, bottom 10
too. Amongst the sad things, like, it doesn't even get the gaming right. like, you know, and if you're a fanboy that goes to the mat for that one, God help you.
But you know what? The irony of that is that all three of us are completely the target audience for Ready Player One. We all grew up in the 80s, loving pop culture and movies and video games. Like, and yeah, just because we recognize there's a thing you know, and there's a thing you know, and there's a really obscure thing that you know, so extra points for you. Like, that does not make a script.
Right.
You know?
It's the action sci-fi.
Things I like.
It's the action sci-fi version of the guys who do the scary movies, right? It's, you know, the
Someone's
scary...
phone's buzzing.
I was going to say, who's buzzing?
Not me. I don't know.
Not me.
Is it my phone?
Oh, it's your phone. Oh, no. Did it stop recording?
Oh, it'll stop eventually.
Are we still recording, Nick?
Yeah, it's fine.
Is it stopped? No, but is the recording still
going? No. I think it is. Is it still recording? Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Nick is our DP.
learning on the job. I'll put it on Do Not Disturb.
I can't wait till a few years from now you're pointing out the style of Nick's photography, his cinematography. Like, you know, and in typical Nick Lemire fashion, he hits the button and then runs off to play video games.
What were you saying about action sci-fi?
Oh, you know, it's the action sci-fi equivalent of, say, the guys who do... Scary Movie right, which is like
Seltzer and Friedberg.
We're going to do something. We're going to throw in something you recognize, and so you'll think you'll like it, right? And
it's not enough.
Yeah, it's not even like we don't have to make a joke. We can just be like, see, here's this thing, and you know what this thing is. Yeah.
Ta-da.
I was torn on mine in terms of, because like the thing with the worst list is like, do you go with a movie that was so bad it sucked the life out of you, or do you go with a movie that was so bad it was crazily entertaining yet still bad the whole time? And I went with the latter on The Hurricane Heist.
I don't think I ever saw that. I don't know how I missed it.
Oh, man.
It's pretty impressive to steal a hurricane, though.
It is. Like, yeah, it's this whole crazy thing where like these people are trying to steal... you know, like old currency that's about to be shredded at a treasury facility during a hurricane, and then like this meteorologist who's fighting against them and basically sort of using what he knows about the weather against
them.
As though he could control the weather.
So I remember this movie when it was Christian Slater.
Yes.
But and jet skis through the town.
It's much more bonkers
than
that. And
Randy Quaid.
Yes.
And called Hard Rain.
Yes.
These sound less fun than Sharknado.
This is
have you ever seen Hard Rain?
I don't think I have.
You got to see Hurricane Heist. If only for the IT expert lady who's wearing like an evening gown basically and has a gun that matches her dress.
Oh, you know, on your thing of like so stupid it's awesome was Skyscraper this year.
I thought Skyscraper was legit good.
Yeah, no, but it's like that's one of those movies like, oh god, this is so dumb. It's the best.
That crane scene was gnarly.
Oh
yeah,
we enjoyed that.
I mean, I remember people hated that movie. I'm like, well, what are you kidding? It's The Rock versus a building.
It does what it says on the box, right? Matt.
we cannot have this conversation and not at least mention Gaudi.
Gaudi's on my list.
I didn't see Gaudi.
But Gaudi is a thing that's like, I really want you to go see it because it's so bad. It's so bad.
It is colossally.
What about Bruce Willis's Death Wish?
Oh, I didn't see that.
Didn't see it. Yeah. I heard terrible things.
Death Wish. Both the title and how you'll feel.
Yeah. While
you're seeing it.
Yeah. No, but Gotti, like, John Travolta is doing Alec Baldwin doing Donald Trump on SNL. That's what that performance is, with a lot of pouting and a lot of prosthetics too much hair.
Like, so badly written and so weirdly directed by Kevin Connolly.
Yep. It's Scorsese light. Like, he's seen too many Scorsese films and has, you know,
learned all the wrong things.
It's like a lot of the same kind of, like, you know, really amped up camera movements and a lot of pop music
choices,
to punctuate every moment. And it's bad. I agree. On my list, I did mine in alphabetical order on my website just to be egalitarian about it. Bleeding Steel, which is a Jackie Chan movie. I don't think either of you guys saw.
No.
The Competition, which I made you see, Matt. It was Thora Birch and Chris Klein. And it was like February.
Oh, yeah.
I made you watch it, and thank God you did, so I was not alone. Where they have, it's like this, it's like a misogynist kind of battle of the sexes movie where the two of them have some competition about who can make their friends cheat first to prove her point that nobody is faithful.
Yeah.
And they have zero chemistry, and it looks really cheap. It's like The Room.
Yeah, that's the one where I remembered, I was reminded of Alonzo Duraldi's famous line that I had miscredited at the time. Chris Klein, who cannot walk into a room convincingly.
I have Dark Crimes on mine. This is a Jim Carrey Polish thriller.
Missed that one.
He grew a beard longer than yours, Alonzo, which means gravitas. He's trying to be serious. He plays a Polish police detective. Gotti's on mine. I hate to trash the lovely Judy Greer, but A Happening of Monumental Proportions
was her. It was not.
Ensemble, like, one day in L.A. movie where all of these people's lives intertwine, and it's like Common and Camille Nanjiani and Alice and Janney and Bradley Whitford, and anyway, it's bad. Mm. Rob Riggle. Happy Time Murders I have on mine. Life Itself I have. Nutcracker. Welcome to Marwen.
Woo!
It was a late entry, as was Show Dogs.
I didn't see Show Dogs, but I heard about it.
I'd forgotten about Show Dogs, and then a very astute reader pointed out, like,
they had to go back and re-edit because there was a whole plot point about the dog learning to allow somebody else to manipulate his genitals, because that's a thing that happens in dog shows.
Right.
But then parents were like, this movie is grooming kids to be victims of pedophiles.
Right. It teaches the dog, it's a undercover dog. It's like Miss Congeniality, but at a dog show. And it's this Rottweiler voiced by Ludacris, who has to go undercover into this dog.
Oh, it's not a documentary. No.
It's a dog show pageant movie. And so he has to go undercover and, Will Arnett is his human handler / police partner.
His Tom Hanks in this Trevor Hooch universe.
And so one part of it is that, you know, during the competition, they grope your genitals to feel what kind of specimen you are. And the ludicrous Rottweiler police dog is like, I don't want to do that. So he's taught to go to his happy place in his mind and block it all out. So children's advocacy groups are like, you are suggesting how kids should deal with trauma. Anyway, but it was bad before then. This is not what makes it bad. I also have Winchester on mine.
Winchester was boring, but I don't know if it was...
Poor Helen Mirren.
Boy, 2018 was a long year.
I'm not going to disagree with you. That was pretty lame. I had Christopher Robin on mine. I thought that was an ill-conceived...
I didn't see that.
...follow-up to where, like, not only is it about Christopher Robin's midlife crisis, but we also find out that Winnie the Pooh and all those other things weren't just, like, toys that only he could talk to. They were living, sentient beings that he abandoned.
Is it like Stewie and Family Guy, though, where only he can talk to them?
No. That's a
Everyone
thing.
Can.
Find out everybody can hear them.
That's confusing to me.
Yeah, it's very bad.
Did those toys not get the memo from Toy Story? Like, that's okay. They just sit and wait.
Exactly. But no, that's not what they do here. Mm. And this movie, it was co-written by Alex Ross Perry.
Oh, that is really strange.
Who I thought, okay, well, I want to see that sensibility.
It's
going to
be dark
Disney,
and mean. I want the dark, mean Christopher Robin movie, but this is not it, apparently.
And like Mary Poppins, it is a movie with a, like, third act ticking clock chase scene for some, like, businessy thing to happen, you know?
You know what's amazing, to get totally off topic for a sec, because we can?
Oh,
The divisive nature of Mary Poppins Returns is totally amazing to me, because I thought, this is safe, and this is light, and this is fun, and everyone's going to dig it.
It's
totally freaking delightful, unless you're Manola Dargis or Justin Chang or Alonzo Duraldi, who also did not love it. And I walked out of it going, everyone's going to love this. This is your big Hollywood crowd pleaser. But then there are people who don't love it, like you.
So. Look, and again, I gave it a fresh, but I gave it the lowest fresh I could. I still think, I wish they had been, they had allowed themselves the freedom to not just make Mary Poppins again. Whoever called it the Force Awakens of
Mary Poppins. Yeah, that was me.
Right. I think that's totally valid.
Why do you think they did it?
Like, well, it clearly,
because they want to tap into your sense of nostalgia.
See, if it was Warner Brothers, they'd have done the grim, dark Mary Poppins. That's what would
you would have seen the pearls falling in slow motion on the sidewalk.
You know, a late-breaking entry for Worst of the Year, as far as I'm concerned, was The Mule.
Yeah, the mule's not good. Terrible.
Everybody in that movie should have known better.
And actually, had I not had such an early deadline for mine, Holmes and Watson would totally have been on
that list. I think that might be part of why they put it out so late and didn't screen it. To avoid the ignominious top 10 worst list.
It's worth noting that Mule and Marwin screened for critics after most critics groups voted. And
they wouldn't show them to us. Yeah.
And Holmes and Watson screened after most people had submitted their worst 10 list.
Was there even a screening of Holmes and Watson?
Nope. It opened on Christmas Day. And some hardy souls actually went out Christmas Eve night to go review it. And I was like, nope, I'm going to go on the 26th. You are not ruining my Christmas.
Like a civilized person.
Yeah, like that was a rule I set down for myself when remember they did the same thing with the Point Break remake. It opened on Christmas Day with no press releases, no press screenings. And I said at the wrap, I'm not, no, 26th. Ooh. Y'all get this on the 26th. And they were all, yes, fine, of course.
Okay.
No one is dying to, you know, get that review.
This is my kid running back and forth. He's shirking his filmmaking duties here. Well, is that a good opportunity then for us to begin talking about Holmes and Watson?
Well, I think that's going to be a separate segment for you YouTube people, but it's all going to be part of this podcast. Where can they find the podcast, Christy?
I don't know.
Well, at the moment, as always, at the moment,
breakfast all day.
It's at ChristyLemire.com, but we are working on, hopefully by the end of today, Friday, it will be on iTunes and other places where you know, fine podcasts are sold.
But we're linking to it on like Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and all that stuff.
Yes.
So look for us there.
We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as BeFast All Day, and you can drop us a line at BeFastAllDayPod@gmail.com.
Thanks, baby. Cool.
And special guest star, Nick Lemire in his pajamas.
It's just me and Alonzo now. Thank you, Nick, for your cinematography skills.
If this is your first time, welcome to Breakfast All Day. It's the new What the Flick? Is that what we're going to call it, I guess? Anyway, What the Flick is over, but Breakfast All Day is what's happening now, and we have one phone as opposed to a crew of camera people, so, you know, this is what it's going to look like for a while.
At my dining room table. Welcome.
Yes.
Welcome. We're having some tea and technical difficulties here. Matt was here for a bit. We did a whole best of, worst of thing. Matt was here for a while, but had to take off because he has a real job.
Yes, the YouTube video cut off because I didn't know to put it on airplane mode, but if you want the entire conversation, you can catch it on the podcast part. And, so we're carrying on with one of the last movies of 2018 and one of the first movies of 2019. We've each seen one of them.
Why don't you go first?
Fine. So Holmes and Watson is, Will Ferrell reteaming with Eitan Cohen, the director of Get Hard.
Get Hard, which has been in the news lately because of Kevin Hart, which we're also going to talk about.
Indeed. So that was perhaps not the greatest idea to go with. Anyway, it is a wacky version of Sherlock Holmes and Watson as played by Ferrell and John C. Reilly. And it's never funny.
So here's my question. Is part of it that we've had such an oversaturation of various incarnations of Sherlock Holmes that, like, any novelty that might have saved this is just gone?
That's part of it.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, in my review in the wrap, I talked about how in the past few years between, like, Benedict Cumberbatch and Robert Downey Jr. and even, like, the Jude Law TV show, like, there have been all these sort of, you know, not just like versions of Holmes, but sort of permutations and modernizations and tweaking and whatnot.
Which mic are you?
I'm on two. I potted down three.
Okay, thank you.
I switched over to Matt's mic.
Thank you. Sorry.
Not to worry.
Oh, yeah, that is Matt's mic. Go ahead.
Yeah. So anyway, it's one of those things where you can, you know, you start watching these movies like a diagram and you're like, okay, that's a joke. A joke is being, and it's not. Like, you can tell that there's a stab at humor and there's like, oh, they think this is going to kill. And you just one after another, just these things fall to the ground and they're just not funny. And like I saw, you know, because they didn't screen it for the press, right. I saw it with regular paying folks and it was silent as a tomb in there. The closest I got even to a mild chuckle was Rebecca Hall, who plays an MD, who of course they can't fathom the fact that a woman is a doctor. And, you know, her notion that basically sort of 19th century science is, you know, as modern as anything's ever going to get. So, you know, everything's about electroshock therapy and all these ridiculous things that don't work. And, I mean, not that, I mean, there are some still clinical uses for electroshock therapy, but not in the way that they do in this movie.
So it's meant to be like a satire, like, ooh, women can't be doctors. And it's meant to, like, make fun of misogyny for the ridiculousness of it?
Yeah, it's meant, they're supposed to be, like, you know, ridiculous men for not wrapping their heads around it, but it's just not funny.
I wonder how much of it was just they were relying on Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly to show up and just be Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly.
I don't doubt it. This has all the earmarks of the sort of lazy modern comedy of like, it doesn't matter if we don't have a script. They're going to make magic happen on the set. And they did not. And along the way managed to waste the talents of like Ralph Fiennes, who plays Professor Moriarty, and Kelly MacDonald, who plays the Mrs. I forget her name, the housekeeper. And you know, even like there's a moment where we meet Mycroft Holmes and he's played by Hugh Laurie.
Oh, wow. That's an amazing cast.
Yeah. And all it made me think of was the fact that Mycroft Holmes, as played by Hugh Laurie's old comedy partner, Stephen Fry, was the best thing about the second Robert Downey Sherlock Holmes movie.
I have blanked all of those from my mind. I just recall that they were like noisy and frenetic.
I had to go pull up the review to remember it. But yeah.
Sorry.
So anyway, yeah, Holmes and Watson is a total waste of time and almost, you know, it got like a low cinema score. The reviews have been terrible. It's not even just like, oh, I'm a snotty person who doesn't enjoy comedy. No, this is just terrible. And it comes on, it's capping off a great year for John C. Reilly, who in The Sisters Brothers and Stan and Ollie, I think, gives like two of the year's most solid performances.
Right. And I know you're not as in love with the Wreck-It Ralph sequel as Matt and I are, but, you know, he's really good in that.
Sure,
and has
find
a wide range within that vocal performance. So I think he's quite lovely there. Did you happen to watch on New Year's Day the Rose Parade coverage with Corden Tish?
No, I miss it this time.
See, that's the, and I love the idea of that. It's Will Ferrell and Molly Shannon, and they're doing like,
I saw it last year.
It's like a fake Rose Parade commentator team, and they're just,
but they go to
idiots.
The actual Rose Parade.
They go there, and it's a whole, like, they've created an infrastructure for them. Like, there's their entire Twitter handles and hashtags, and they're making it seem like it's a real thing. And it's the two of them just being like vapid, idiotic commentators. And I love the idea of that. And we watched it for a bit, Chris and I did, and we're like, I'm not laughing yet. Are you?
Yeah,
the execution, and maybe that's what happened here as well. Like, you expect Will Ferrell to just show up and be Will Ferrell, but maybe you need a little more structure than that.
Yeah, the Corden Tish stuff, like, it reminds me of, did you see A Deadly Adoption?
I know what it is, yes.
The Lifetime movie that Will Ferrell and Kristen Wiig did, where it was just, the joke was how much exactly like a Lifetime movie it was. Corden Tish are so believable as just crappy local anchor types that they aren't all that funny.
It's too dead on.
Yeah, you know, like I watched the Rose Parade last year. I even watched when they covered the Royal Wedding.
Oh, right.
And it was just kind of like, I get what you're going for here. And yeah, Holmes and Watson, there were moments where like, okay, I get what you're going for here, but it's not working. And then other times it was like, I get what you're going for here, and that's stupid.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was a big letdown.
I wonder if they can feel it. I wonder, like, when you're on set and it's just death, I wonder if that creeping sense of dread comes in, or are you so convinced of what you're doing during the doing of it that you're pumped and it's going to be awesome?
Comedy is so hard that way. And I bet like another editor could maybe even go through that footage and
salvage,
squeeze something out of it. But who knows? It's hard to say. But it doesn't work.
What's your number?
Oh, I think I gave it a 0.5 or something. I'd have to look it up on.
It's that bad.
Yeah.
You didn't laugh at all.
No.
Like, not a single time.
Like I said, mild chuckles for Rebecca Hall. That was it.
It's like Happy Time Murders, which was on both of our worst of lists. Like, we laughed a couple times. Like, there's one joke in particular on Happy Time Murders that I recall very vividly because I was like, yay, laughter. but it sounds like that's not even happening so much here.
No, not at all. Now, talk about Escape Room, because that looks actually kind of fun.
Escape Room's really actually pretty cool. So this was the first screening of 2019 on January 2nd. I went and saw Escape Room on the Sony lot. And I feel like a lot of us probably walked into it with the expectation of, oh God, it's the first movie January. Back. It's the first, and it just is, you know, it's just dumping ground time. It just does not bode well. We're all caught up in preparations for awards shows, and people are into regular folks who see movies out there are getting caught up with whatever looks good. And
yeah, like stuff that only opened in New York and LA is now going to be making its way out to the rest of the country.
Trickling
and,
out, yes. Yeah. So Escape Room is shockingly fun, though. So it is the kind of premise we have seen in a lot of different horror movies where a bunch of disparate types are thrown together and they've got to figure out a way to survive. And here it is. It's in Chicago. And there's maybe 6-8 people, and they don't know each other, but they've all received a very mysterious invitation to take part in this escape room. And they each get this very ornate box that's very hard to open. But once you figure out how to open it, you get instructions to go to this place. And so you have a woman who is an Iraq war veteran, and you have a guy who is a total expert on escape rooms and has done a million of them and knows all the rules, and like he's pumped for this one because this one seems really real. And there's a young woman who's a college student who is very shy but clearly brilliant and really good with puzzles, and so she is there. And so you have all these different types, and they get thrown together, and pretty quickly they realize that their lives are actually in danger. This is not just a very elaborate...
The game has become real.
Yes, yes. And, I mean, from the very beginning, there's so much thought that has gone into the details and the rules and the underlying gimmick, which they find out in time, is that they've all been picked for a reason. This is not a spoiler. They're not random people.
You don't say.
Yeah, they've all been picked for a reason, and the game is tailored to who they are. I would say that the ultimate reveal of what is happening here is not as interesting as just being with them every step of the way. Mm. You do watch them reveal themselves and have to work together. It's kind of like, you know, it goes back to Survivor 20 years ago, when Survivor was interesting, when it was still novel, the reality show Survivor.
Did you see Cube?
I don't think I did. What was Cube?
Cube, I thought about it when I was reading the plot synopsis, and then Bibbs mentioned it in his review. Cube was a 1997 Canadian film about, again, these people who were sort of thrown together in this room, in this cube, and have to figure out like how to escape from it. This is before the whole sort of escape room phenomenon. But that's the same. It's the same deal. Like seemingly random strangers, but not.
Right.
And, you know, you each has their own specific set of skills that comes to bear and how they get out of the situation.
Yes. Adam Robitaille directed this, who did
Insidious: The Last Key.
The most recent Insidious from last year.
Which was the first film of 2018.
Yeah. This is his sweet spot.
Apparently.
Ignominious first week of January.
Well, Will Smith used to be for July 4th. This guy is for the first week of January.
Yeah, and let's see, did he write this too? No. Braggy F. Shoot is, he looks, I don't know who he is. But,
okay.
It is visceral. It is tense. It is very clever over and over again. Mm-hmm. It moves really well. I'm shocked at how good Escape Room is. So if you want the escape from, you know, the
prestige,
serious, heavy stuff that matters. Mm. Like if you don't have it in you to go see Capernaum or whatever foreign language movies out there that looks totally depressing or whatever it is, Escape Room is actually shockingly fun.
Not that there's anything wrong with Capernaum. I hear it's very good.
I found it relentlessly bleak.
Oh, okay.
I actually saw it.
Maybe there is something wrong with Capernaum.
Yeah, I didn't really love it. But I want to mention a couple people in the cast. I really like Taylor Russell as the young woman who is the brilliant college student. She is Judy Robinson on Lost in Space, which I don't know. Did you ever watch Lost in Space, the TV show?
I watched the pilot and I really liked it, and then I haven't circled back to it yet, but I need to.
Okay.
How is Logan Miller from my beloved Take Me to the River?
Oh, right. He is kind of squirrely. And he has the biggest arc, I would say.
Huh, okay.
Yes.
Yeah, that's become his wheelhouse. He played like he was in A Dog's Life and in Love, Simon, and he's always now he plays a lot of jerks.
He was in Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse.
Yes, he was.
Who was he in Love, Simon? I don't remember.
He's the one who outs Simon.
Oh, right. He's the jerk.
Yeah.
He's kind of a jerk here, too, but he learns.
Okay.
He gets to learn and change. The escape room is actually a crucible.
Ooh.
It reveals who you actually are or can be or whatever.
Okay.
So I am really shocked at how much fun Escape Room is. And
What's your number?
I actually recommend it. I would say like a 7.2.
Ooh,
yeah.
Okay.
I don't like the ending. Not that it pulls the rug out from under you, but I don't know that I needed that much hand-holding. Like, the mystery of what's going on here is more interesting than what
reveal.
The truth of it ends up being.
Gotcha.
So, yeah. So, we say don't see Holmes and Watson, but perhaps do see Escape Room.
I'm seeing it this weekend, actually, because we're talking about a new Cheyenne next week.
There you go. So, you get to play catch-up with it.
All right. Well, hey, we are BeFast All Day on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And you can drop us a line at BeFastAllDayPod@gmail.com.
And somebody will answer.
I promise.
Hi there. We are back. Thank you, Nick, for pressing record.
Welcome back to Breakfast All Day.
We're still Breakfast All Day.
Yes.
It's getting closer to noon, but we're still having breakfast.
Because it's all day. I'm Alonzo. That's Christy.
Hi.
For those of you just joining us on YouTube, if you're listening to the podcast, you get to hear us introduce ourselves over and over again.
We're super interesting.
Enjoy that. And to those of you on YouTube, I do have a mouth. You just can't see it because I'm talking through a microphone.
So we have a little bit of movie news to talk about, a bit of a follow-up to something we discussed a few weeks back, and that involves Kevin Hart maybe hosting the Oscars or not hosting the Oscars. To take you back a little bit, he was asked to host the Oscars, and that seemed like kind of a fun choice. You know, he's got a lot of energy. He could maybe breathe life into this kind of traditional and sometimes painfully stuffy and overlong ceremony.
And his movies make money, and so that's certainly a boost for that.
He helps diversify, and that's one of the goals, certainly, of the Academy these days. And then several, tweets of his?
Tweets, yeah.
That were homophobic.
From years past.
Resurfaced.
Yes. And rather than sort of address them and say, you know, look, this is not who I am anymore, he immediately took the defensive and was all like, why are we bringing this up again? I already apologized for this, which he hadn't really. And once an ultimatum was delivered from the Academy that he really needed to apologize for this, then he decided that his presence would be a distraction. So now he didn't want to do it anymore. And then in the weeks since then, they haven't found anybody else who wanted to do the gig. And now suddenly Ellen DeGeneres has placed herself in the middle of this as a former Oscar host and as a member of the LGBT community and is saying that, no, Kevin should host the Oscars after all. To which I say bullshit. Kevin Hart, may not be the person who tweeted, you know, as he did 10 years ago, that if his son acted gay, he would smash a dollhouse on his head. But he never really sufficiently appropriately apologized for the nature of this joke, in quotes. And 3 years ago, he made Get Hard, which is a thoroughly homophobic movie. And, do I believe that he's capable of changing? Absolutely. Do I think that he has done so to an extent that this is a non-issue and we shouldn't talk about it anymore? No, it's still an issue. And I think if he winds up hosting the Oscars, it's still going to be an issue and it's still going to be talked about. And if he thinks it's going to magically go away because his friend Ellen stepped forward on his behalf, I think he's got another thing coming.
Yeah, he said in this interview with Ellen DeGeneres, which I guess is coming out soon, Ellen herself has posted it on Twitter, so it's out there for you to see, that he said he didn't want to be a distraction and it had become distraction. It was a dream of his and he didn't want to harm this thing that he loved. So Ellen has posted this. She is, you know, beseeching the Academy to rethink Kevin Hart's hosting possibilities, and she posted on Twitter an hour ago, however you feel about this, the only positive way through it is to talk about it. Thank you for being here at Kevin Hart for Real with a little heart emoji. So, and it's you know, understandably divisive. Like, just because she steps in and, like, she's very powerful and very influential and very beloved by a wide cross-section of people.
Yeah.
Does that all of a sudden absolve things? No.
She is not the spokesperson for all queer people
ever. No. Yeah. Well, so then Mark Harris also tweets about this. He says, this is wrong. To a certain type of celebrity, the internet is a mob. Critics are haters. And those who think someone with a long history of homophobic statements shouldn't host the Oscars are standing in the way of a dream. Yeah, so.
Yeah, and as Louis Vertel said, if you're really somebody who used to be homophobic and isn't anymore, then you should be comfortable with apologizing over and over and over again for the person that you used to be, rather than getting mad at people for not accepting your previous weak tea, I'm sorry if you were offended apologies, which is what he's doing. And like, there's just such a sense of entitlement and how dare you with this. It's like, no, dude, you have to actually address this really awful shit you said. And a lot of it is not, does not even fall under the rubric of it was a joke. We're not talking about, oh, we're censoring comedians. No, he talked about like committing homophobic violence against a child, which guess what? A lot of parents actually do. Look it up. There's a lot of horrible like deaths and injuries of children because they acted gay or whatever. This is a real thing, and it's not something for, you know, just because it's getting in the way of Kevin Hart's career ambitions, we still need to talk about it.
Yeah, Kay Austin Collins, who's a film critic for Vanity Fair, I want to say, right? Vanity Fair, yeah. He tweets, Ellen doesn't represent this country. Holland Taylor does. We redistricted. You appealed to the wrong lesbian, my man. So it's divisive in real ways and in jokey ways. So at the time, you know, a couple weeks ago when Kevin Hart apologized, when he stepped down, we talked about it here. And I said, like, if it had been, yeah, a legitimate heartfelt apology, that would have gone a long way. But there were all these caveats to it. What has to happen now? Like, what can he do or say now? Or nothing? Or do we just walk away with Kevin Hart and find somebody else entirely?
I don't know. When he did step down, he gave much closer to a legit apology than he had previously. But now he is back to where he started, which is like, how dare you, man, my growth, you know. I don't know what the answer is here, and I don't presume to speak for everyone to say, like, what should happen. But I think that Ellen is being disingenuous by thinking that somehow having this conversation absolves him from the larger conversation, and that now his presence at the Oscars wouldn't be a distraction. You know, I want people who fuck up in public and grow and learn things to do the work of actually, you know, like walking the walk instead of just talking the talk, you know, like do legitimate things that benefit queer people and use your platform and your fame and your spotlight to benefit people who need it, instead of lamenting the fact that somehow, you know, because people are being vocal about this stuff now, you're being denied an opportunity. You know,
right. He's incredibly powerful and incredibly wealthy. And yeah, he could hire or tell more stories that, you know, are more diverse in terms of queer identity.
You know, or like, here's the thing that so many of these like powerful men who get in trouble don't ever seem to want to do is shut up and listen, you know, like shut up and actually take some of these things to heart, if you'll pardon the expression, and acknowledge that maybe the people who are upset at you have a point and aren't just haters. You know, that maybe you did say something that was genuinely problematic and that you need to evolve as a person and figure out what that is, rather than immediately go on the defensive and decide that, like, you know, that you're being wronged by the world and boohoo. That's my thing.
Let me do one more tweet. This is from Travell Anderson.
Yes, please.
As a black queer someone who, when my body began to manifest aspects of my identity even I was unaware of, was punched in the chest by black men in my family and told to quote-unquote man up, Ellen can't and doesn't speak for me. So
yeah. Listen to Travell. Always listen to Travell. He knows what he's talking about.
Anyway, so we will continue to follow.
Yeah,
we'll continue to follow this. We will, because it's not going anywhere. Oscar nominations are coming out, what, in a couple of weeks? The Golden Globes are this weekend. Yeah. Oscar nominations are coming out soon. This is not going anywhere. So
no.
They've got to find a host. Yeah. It's coming soon.
Well, or like, you know, have multiple hosts or whatever. You know, I just, the Oscars, there's a lot going on this year. Like, you know, I'm still mad that they've taken so many of the smaller categories and are sort of shunting them to the commercials or whatever. It's, you know, I'm still mad that they give so little time to the governor's dinner, you know, in the fall, where they honor people like Cicely Tyson and, you know, the people who get like the Life Achievement Awards. So, you know, we're learning and we're restructuring and figuring out what's going on, and hopefully they are too. But yeah, Kevin Hart, like, seriously, sit down, listen, have some meetings with people. Figure out what you did wrong and how you can fix it. It's not my job to tell you that, but, like, this immediate stance of defensiveness and you know, how dare you deprive me of this, I just find unpalatable.
The Oscars are on February 24th.
All right.
They're coming soon. Anyway, so we will keep up with this because it's interesting. Mm-hmm. I know you don't usually like talking about awards, Alonzo, but this is interesting in a lot of ways.
No, it's in the culture for sure. All right, hey, so listen, everybody, this is our new thing. This is where we are. So follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at BeFastAllDay. You can drop us a line at BeFastAllDayPod@gmail.com. And we'll be back next week with more reviews and hopefully Matt and Ben, who knows? But, you know, we'll figure it out.
Next week is The Upside, which is a remake of a French kind of feel-good buddy comedy, and A Dog's Way Home about doggies who are lost. So I'm getting ready to cry now. thank you so much for sticking with us at Breakfast All Day, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.